Good afternoon and welcome to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. We're going to listen today to a conversation I had in November 2024 with the best-selling author Ann Patchett. She's the author of 9 novels, 4 collections of essays, and 3 works for children. She's received lots of awards, including the National Humanities Medal and a Pen Faulkner Award. Her novel, The Dutch House, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Her latest book is an annotated edition of her most popular novel, Bel Canto, which was published to great acclaim in 2001. Anne walks us through what she wrote, page by page, commenting in handwritten marginalia about what works and what she thinks could be improved. The placement of a comma, the rephrasing of a clause, the excising of a metaphor, and a host of other insights and reactions to the work that brought her to the attention of millions of readers. And she shares these insights into her creative process with the same kind of grace, humor, and gifts of perception that draw us all to her novels and essays. It's another fantastic read by one of America's preeminent writers. Ann Patchett joined us on Zoom from Nashville. Congratulations on this book. This is a terrific read, and it's really interesting to me because I can't think of any other book like it. Tell us about the derivation of the idea for this. It started as an idea for a charity auction on another book.
Right. So there's a little bookstore outside of Boston called Newtonville Books, and they had been hard hit by the pandemic. They were in debt trying to raise some money. And so they asked about 20 writers to annotate by hand one of their books. I did my last novel, Tom Lake. What's amazing to me when I think about it is this was a year ago. They asked me probably, I don't know, in August of last year to hand the book in January of this year. I am someone who always does my homework immediately. I'm whatever the opposite of a procrastinator is. And so I had it finished by September. I thought, I'll just wait and send it in later. When it was time to mail it in, I looked at it again and I thought, this is actually really an interesting document. And I really enjoyed doing it. And so I didn't want to give it to them. Just one thing, it would be lost forever. So I got another copy of Tom Lake out and I hand copied all of my annotations into a second copy, mailed them the first one.
You didn't make a photocopy of the book.
I didn't make a photocopy because I didn't want to break the spine of the book. And actually in rewriting everything, that's when I saw what the worth of the project really was. And I thought, this is an interesting document on how novels get written and what the process of thought is. So I sent the Tom Lake that I had copied to my editor, Jonathan Burnham. And I said, do you think there's anything here? And he thought it was a very interesting project. I said, I don't want to do Tom Lake. It's too recent. I'll either do Bel Canto or I'll do The Dutch House. And when we were having this conversation, and it was in January of this year, I was in Aspen giving a talk at the Aspen Institute that night, and every single person who came to the table said, oh my God, Bel Canto is my favorite book. And so I thought, well, all right, that's it. The readers have spoken. And I sat down and did this annotation of Bel Canto. And somewhere along the way, when I was about halfway through, I thought, as a bookseller, because I own a bookstore in Nashville, no book is going to come out on November 6th. All books are published the first Tuesday of the month. And so November 6th is just a hell of a time to try to publish a book. But bookstores need books to sell. So I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could get this done in time to publish it on Election Day just for booksellers? Like there's no loss for me. The book's already come out. HarperCollins didn't pay me to do it. You know, I just did it because I wanted to do it. And here it is.
And here it is. And it's fascinating. And also, is there a precedent for this? I couldn't find one. There are scholarly annotations of everything from the Bible to everything else. But Has an author ever published this kind of page by page, paragraph by paragraph, elucidation of one of their novels?
You know, after I had done this, there was a copy of Kitchen Confidential that Tony Bourdain had written some notes on, but it's like a sentence every 10 pages, and it's just a few words. So there really isn't anything like this that talks about the process of writing the book, because annotation is something that happens to the work of dead people by scholars, and it's typed.
Yeah. This is and we should tell folks who haven't seen the book yet, this is in your hand, right. In the sides of all of the pages. Yeah.
And my editor said, well, you know, of course, when we do this, it'll be typed. And I said, no, I think what makes it really cool, actually, is that it's in my handwriting. And ultimately, that became one of the really interesting parts of the whole process. I did this over and over again. They reformatted the book so I would have nice big margins and there are fewer words on the page. And I kept going through it, adding notes, recopying the whole thing. When it was all done, they sent me a draft of the page proofs with a piece of vellum taped onto every page. I got about 20 different vellum pens, did handwriting samples, and then they said, okay, this is the best pen for the printing process. So I wrote it all on vellum, and then they take it off and they put it through the printing. And it's amazing how well it turned out. It really just is, this is exactly what my handwriting looks like.
Yeah, and it's crystal clear. There's no trouble whatsoever reading it and understanding it, and it's right
Catholic
there.
Catholic school.
Yeah, Catholic school.
12 years of Catholic school.
That's
good
right.
Penmanship.
Good penmanship, exactly. Now, with a book like this that's been, you know, out for 20-something years, it was published in 2001, you do talk about, in this book, about how some changes had been made from the original publication. So when they did, you know, additional
right.
printings, for example, the word terrorist was changed to guerrilla. And
yes.
That was even in response to some readers. Is that right?
Yes. I got so many complaints. One of the things that I came to learn with Bel Canto is that people who read books often have time to write to the author and tell them what they did wrong. And I would just kind of put all of those letters in a box. And at one point, there was a re-edition of the book that was the movie tie-in edition, which is funny because about 10 people saw that movie. And I said to my editor, can I go back and make some corrections? There was an egregious mistake in a scene where the characters are playing chess that I must have gotten 200 letters about. So I was really, really happy to correct that. So yes, when I did this version, I said, I want to go all the way back to the original so I can point out all of these crazy things that were wrong.
Are you considering the next edition of Bel Canto that's not annotated to include the changes that you're suggesting to yourself in this book?
No, and I really thought about that. When I was about halfway through, I kept thinking, you know what? You're not correcting these things. You're highlighting them. You're drawing attention to your mistakes. And I live in Nashville, where we think about very little besides Taylor Swift, but that might just be something that happens all over the world now. But the whole notion of Taylor's version, I could do Bel Canto Taylor's version, where I did just fix it and then republish it. But what would happen is that everyone who had read it in 2001 would then say, oh, it was so much better before she messed with it. So by circling and bracketing and underlining and making margin notes and saying, this is very sloppy, this is very bad and very good. I've got to say a lot of things about the book were really good, but by highlighting the mistakes I think it becomes a great thing for writers, for students, for book clubs, for people, and for editors. A friend of mine said this is a master class in editing,
It
which
sure is. Yeah,
I
it's
really
exact.
loved. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. And I know of musicians who've done this. I mean, Igor Stravinsky, when he moved from Russia to America, changed like four notes of every piece he had ever written so that he could
Wow.
publish them in America and get the royalties from the American publication because he
Well,
was.
that's Taylor's, that's Igor
Yeah.
Stravinsky, Taylor's version. Yeah.
Exactly, because he was doing Taylor's version a long time before Taylor.
Right.
But Paul Simon published or released an album where he reimagined, 12 songs, and just
Oh.
arranged them differently, added lyrics, took out stuff, put stuff in, and it's revelatory. It's fantastic. There's a one of the songs on the album, Renee and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war. It's completely different than the original thing he published,
What's
and.
the title of the album? Do you know?
Blue Sky, I think, or
Okay.
something like that. I don't have it
I'll
in
get it
front of me,
today.
but yeah,
Yeah.
it's really fantastic. Now you say in this book, in the introduction, you say this is a good book, but not my best, which means I have to ask you, well, which one is? I have my opinion. I just wondered what yours was.
I don't know if it's the best, but my favorite book, for all my life, when people have asked me that question, I have always said, oh, my favorite book is the book I'm working on right
Right.
now. Blah, blah, blah,
You
blah.
have to, right.
But actually, it's Commonwealth. Commonwealth is the book that I love, because it's the story of my life. It's my autobiographical novel, and it's a book that I could write for the rest of my life. I could just keep adding on volume after volume to Commonwealth.
It is a great book, and I can't disagree. I loved the one before that, Run. But I think Dutch House is the one for me that just stands out. And I love Tom Lake. So
Oh,
those,
thanks.
and these are more recent books. But, the whole notion of best and, second best and third best is kind of silly. But I.
Let me just say, I have always thought of my novels in threes. And the first three, the second three, the third three, they are like different epics of my life. And so Commonwealth and the Dutch House and Tom Lake are the most recent three, and I think they are better books than the first three or the middle three.
We're talking about Ann Patchett's latest publication, the annotated edition of Bel Canto. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. You say in the introduction to this book again, I'm a better writer now, and proof of it is all over these pages. So, what are you better at? Are you a better first draft writer? Do you write faster, easier, quicker? What are you better at?
I don't write in drafts, and I'm certainly not faster. The way I write now, and it's funny because I have been writing all morning, like up until 3 minutes before this show began, I have been writing a novel all day. And I just fiddle. I fiddle with the sentences. I move things around in a paragraph. I go back and rework things. I read aloud constantly. I have a clarity that I didn't have when I was younger. I think when I was younger, I was just all about the way it sounded. Something could just sound pretty. But now I think so much about whether or not it's true, whether or not it would really happen that way, and what is the clearest way I can tell that to the reader. And I don't know if that has to do with writing newspaper op-eds or children's books. Picture books have actually been very good for the way I write and the way I think. I enjoy Henry James. I enjoy all sorts of writers who write in a very Baroque way. But for myself, I want to write things as clearly as possible.
And it's that the sound of the sentences.
Very
I'm
much.
very much interested in this. You write so musically. I mean, I'm a musician, so I think in those terms anyway. But for example, here's one of the changes you suggest to yourself. The first sentence is, he knew his life was probably over, and knowledge of this fact gave him a temerity that he found useful. And you changed the second half of that sentence to say, and the knowledge gave him a useful temerity.
Yes.
And I agree with you. It's better. I don't always agree with you with some of the cuts you want to make on yourself. And we'll argue about those in a bit. But what about that first version strikes your ear as wrong? Can you articulate why it's not wrong, but not as good?
I'm using too many words to say the exact same thing. And in little placeholders such as in fact add nothing. You know, can we take that out? Can we take that out? That's what I'm interested in.
Yeah, you do a lot of excising. There's a lot of words that are bracketed saying, oh, don't need it. Don't need
yeah.
it. You say the beautiful images are ruined by overpopulation.
Yes.
So this economy is really important. But there are a couple of times where I thought, you know, the economy it sacrifices something. Is it okay if we argue about one or two?
Oh,
there you go.
Listen, you'll get no argument from me. I just think it is just about looking at it and thinking about it. So, yeah, we don't have to agree at all.
One of them was, he was not a loose button, a hem in need of shortening. And you wanted to get rid of the hem in need of shortening.
You're saying the same thing twice.
Except the next sentence is, this is not the jungle, and he was not a primitive man. So there seemed balance to me. He was not a loose button, a hem in need of shortening. This is not the jungle, and he was not a primitive man. There's an evenness to the teeter-totter on that one that I kind of liked.
Well, I liked it as well once.
Yeah, once, back in the day.
Right? Back in the day. And now I just, it's about, to me, it's about trusting the reader. Can the reader get to the same place with fewer words, fewer images? Because sometimes you're thinking about one thing and then another. There's an image in the book about birds that are yellow like chrysanthemums landing in a tree. I mean, it would be wonderful if I had it here and I could tell you where it was. But when I read it again, I was thinking, okay, they're looking out the window. There's the tree. There are the two birds and then chrysanthemums. You know, it's like you're making your brain go in so many different directions that you are not staying in the moment with the characters.
Yeah, and there is one place where you identify an entire paragraph and you say, I've purposely sort of vaguely described this so that the reader can fill in her yeah. mind what else is going on. And the images the reader will conjure would be better than anything you could write down.
Especially where fear or violence or love are concerned. You know, the sort of big emotions, you want to just give a little bit of an outline so the reader can tap into their own experience.
Ann Patchett's new book is an annotated edition of Bel Canto, her best-selling novel that was published in 2001. We'll have more with Ann Patchett on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us. Superstar soprano Renee Fleming singing music of Puccini. Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're listening to a conversation with one of my favorite authors who's a favorite of readers around the world. Ann Patchett is the author of 9 novels, several collections of essays, as well as works for children. We spoke in November of 2024 about her latest book, an annotated edition of Bel Canto, her popular novel about hostages, including a famous soprano, who are being held after a kidnapping gone bad. Bel Canto is about relationships, fame, communication, love, and freedom. This annotated version is in part about how a gifted writer reacts to a work she created 2.5 decades ago. Because our conversation was recorded earlier, we aren't able to take any calls or online comments today. Here's more of my conversation with Anne Patchett. And Anne, of course, you and Renee Fleming are very, very dear friends. And I understand that a record label, Decca, has actually come up with a playlist to accompany the book.
Yes, I'm so excited about this. It's on Spotify. It was oddly much harder somehow to get that together than it was the book. I don't know why, but Renee and I went through along with my editor and picked out the arias that are mentioned in the book or that would go with the book. And Decca put together a playlist, mostly of Renee. There are a few other sopranos on there of all of the pieces that are sung. People have asked me for this for 25 years. And actually, some people have put them together themselves. But this is really, really gorgeous. So if you've got Spotify, download the playlist. It's called something like Anne Patchett's Bel Canto annotation or something like that.
Yeah, that's findable. That's a great idea. Yeah. A lot of people assume that the central character of the book, the soprano Roxanne Coss, is actually based on Renee Fleming, but you are very good friends now, but you didn't really know each other when you wrote this book back in 1999, right?
No, we didn't know each other at all. And when the book came out, so many people thought it was about Renee, largely because the two sopranos sang the same repertoire, which was just an accident on my part, but also because the signature aria of Roxanne Coss is Rusalka's Song to the Moon, which is Renee's signature aria. And back when I wrote this book, that was a very obscure fact. A friend of mine who was a great opera aficionado, I said, come up with something really obscure that will make me look smart. And he said, oh, Rusalka's Song to the Moon. And that was the thing that really sealed it in everyone's mind as being Renee. Now that I know Renee, it would have worked really well. And the thing that bothers me the most in a way about this book are the mistakes that I made about opera. Because as much as I studied and tried to learn about opera before I wrote the book, now for all these years that Renee and I have been friends and I've been going to the opera all the time, I know a whole lot more about the life of sopranos. And those were some bad mistakes.
It's interesting because you said if I had always loved opera at the time you wrote the book, it would have been harder to put it into words. Why is
yes.
that? That's interesting. Why is that?
I think that that's true. There are certain things that when you love, and I think music is one of them, when you just know it in your soul all your life, I think it's much harder to come up with the words of how much it means to you. But if you're looking at it more as an observer, I think it's easier. It was easier then for me to write about opera incorrectly than it is for me to write about opera correctly now.
And when we talk about correctly, there's a sentence in which you reference that she sang a particular role 3 nights in a row.
Right.
And no opera singer does that. I mean, when I was the chorus master for the Baltimore Opera, you know, we were Thursday, Saturday, Monday, Wednesday. You know, there's always a day off in between. There's even a day off in between the dress rehearsal and opening night.
Yes, absolutely.
Because you can't sing 2 nights in a row. It's hard to do this. If you're Taylor Swift, you can, but they have a little amplification to help them out. It's those kinds of mistakes, which I think, you know, most people would not understand or gloss over. But there's a couple of things, and I'm pretty sure that when I read this book years ago, I didn't catch it, because it's page 13 in which you basically tell people what's going to happen at the end.
Right.
I mean, these terrorists are there, and on page 13 you say they all end up dead.
Yeah, the terrorists are going to die and the hostages are going to live.
And
When
that,
everybody would have thought it would be the other way around.
And did you do that back in the day on purpose? Did you didn't
Oh, yeah.
miss that? I mean, you were what's the advantage as the storyteller to, you know, telescoping that ending that early?
The point is, pay attention to what is actually happening. Don't be rushing ahead to see who is going to live and who is going to die. I'll tell you that right now so that you can see the beauty of this moment and these relationships. And then, of course, that's just what we do all through our life. We forget that we are all going to die. Every single day we manage to forget that, and then we plow ahead. But in the moments that we can remember, really understand that this is a finite experience, then I think the world becomes a much more beautiful place, much more precious.
Ann Patchett, we're talking about her new book. It's called Bel Canto, the Annotated Edition. We have a caller on the line. Daphne is in Baltimore. Welcome to the show with Ann Patchett.
Good afternoon. I am calling because I just finished my first Ann Patchett book this morning, and it was These Precious Days.
Oh, that's a good one.
Which I think was an interesting way to be introduced to this author, who I am now committed to reading every book she's written. I was so excited by that particular one. And one reason I think it's so interesting is because it was so autobiographical. I feel like I know her. I know her husband. I know her dad. And it will be interesting then to read the fiction that she's written. But that, you know, collection of essays was very meaningful to me. And as she was talking just now about relationships, I mean, that was what that whole book was about, different relationships and experiences.
Well, congratulations, Daphne. You're in for a treat when you enjoy the rest of Anne's work.
Thank you. Thank you both. And thank you, Daphne, for saying that. There's a great pleasure in writing nonfiction, but I am who I am. And so if I am making a story up, it's still coming from inside me, either from my experiences or from things that interest me or distress me. Zadie Smith said to me once, autobiographical fiction is not about what happens. It's about what we're afraid might happen. It's what we perseverate on all the time. And I think that that's very true. But These Precious Days, just getting to write about what was going on in my life, there was a lot of pleasure in that.
Yeah.
I went to Australia and New Zealand on book tour this summer, and everywhere I went, it was only about that book. There would be a thousand people in an audience all holding that one book. It was the most interesting thing.
Wow. Was there an explanation for that?
I have no idea. But that was the one that caught fire.
Well, it's a beautiful collection. It's terrific. And Daphne, I also very much recommend the set of essays prior to that. This is the story of a happy marriage. It's fantastic. And the novels you're really going to love. You know, we talked a little bit about your preoccupation with economy and wanting to make sure that things are succinct and, you know, saying no more than needs to be said. And you say at one point that metaphors have to make sense.
Yes.
And that's, you know, I had never thought of that. I was so grateful for that insight. And one of the sentences you put up as an example, you say, one day everything had the saturated quality of a book dropped into a bathtub, and the next day the air was bright and crisp. I thought that was terrific, and you chided yourself about that because I guess dropping a book into a bathtub doesn't make sense. What's nonsensical?
It doesn't line up in terms of weather. I mean, if you drop a book in a bathtub, the book swells up, the pages ruffle, you can't close it. But how is that like a day? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Okay. Now I get it.
It doesn't line up.
So the metaphor itself had to have something to do with daylight or night.
Wouldn't that be a good idea? The metaphor itself should have something to do with the thing that you're trying to describe.
I'm going to write that down, Ann. That's great. You always you chide yourself over and over for being long-winded. At one point, you said next to a paragraph, "I read this and I want to scream." Ann Patchett, get to the point. This is the annotation you're writing. Is there ever a time, do you think, you know, and a place for a leisurely, you know, approach to the point? Don't people want to do that sometimes, you know, for whatever reason?
Absolutely. And it is a wonderful thing. It, like I say, Henry James, just ramble all you want. I love it sometimes as a reader, but as a writer, that's not what I want to do. It's not that I think all books need to get to the point, but my gosh, I have been reading a novel. Again, I own a bookstore, so everything I read isn't coming out for 4 or 5 or 6 months. And I've been reading an advance copy of a novel, and I finally just had to stop. It was so bloated. It took the characters 15 pages to walk across the room, and they're talking about the most unimportant details of what they're eating and getting in and out of the car and what they're wearing. And it added nothing to anything. And I finally just thought, okay, enough. The book is 430 pages, and it could have very comfortably been 200.
Because it's interesting, you set yourself up for a very difficult literary challenge in this book, which you pointed out, which I hadn't realized when I read it the first time, that the hostages for page after page in the beginning of the book, for like 100 pages or something, they don't speak. They're not allowed to speak to each other, and they're lying on the floor because the terrorists don't allow them to stand up. So they're not even standing up until page, whatever it is, 100 and something. That's a really difficult thing to sustain for that many pages.
It is madness. And of course, everything about this project is predicated on the fact that I hadn't read the book in 24 years. And when I went back and I read it again for the first time, thinking, okay, now I'm going to annotate it, I'm going to do this, those first 100 pages made me as anxious as I can ever remember being, because I kept thinking, get them off the floor, Patchett, get them talking, get them up. But then I thought, anxiety is the emotion that I am trying to create in the reader. It is the emotion I am creating in myself by keeping everybody on the floor style, silent and still. And they're really just, it's all their thoughts and their memories and their interest in communicating with one another, which they can't do anyway because they don't speak the same language. But the anxiety was the gift of doing that. And it does really hook you.
And just as you remembered writing certain parts of it, at one point you were visiting your dad, and another point you were giving a talk somewhere, and you wrote this scene when you were doing that. And so the place that you wrote many of these scenes came back to you. I wonder if it also came back to you, the edits you were making in the original endeavor of writing the book, and the edits that perhaps you talked about with your editor when you handed in that first draft in 1999. Did that process come back to you as well, and how did that inform this process of revisiting the book now?
The book wasn't edited at all. The editor was a man named Robert Jones, who I had tried very hard to work with on the book before Bel Canto, which was called The Magician's Assistant. And we met and we just loved each other. I felt that Robert Jones was the reader I had been looking for my whole life. And for whatever reason, he wasn't able to buy the book. They had decided they weren't buying any more literary fiction that season. They just, no, he couldn't buy the book. So when I finished Bel Canto, I said to my agent, the only person that I want to work with is Robert Jones at Harper's. And he got the book and he read the manuscript for it while he was waiting in the hospital for what turned out to be a fatal cancer diagnosis. And he went back to his boss and said, "I have cancer, and what I want is this book." And Robert died. The book came out in May of 2001, and Robert died in August. And his memorial service, which I spoke at, was September 10th, 2001. And so anyway, the book wasn't edited. And Robert just said, "This is the greatest joy of my life. This is the book that I love." And I'm not complaining at all because it was wonderful to get to work with him at all. But yeah, that's what it brought back, not edits.
And it's very moving. That's the last page of the book where you write about that. You tell that story, and you write about your deep affection for Robert Jones. Ann Patchett, her new book is Bel Canto, the annotated edition. And we will have more with Ann after a quick break here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. Music from the opera Bel Canto, based on the book by my guest today, Ann Patchett. Ann Patchett's favorite opera is Eugene Onegin by Tchaikovsky. Ann tells us that this is her favorite opera in her latest book, which is an insightful, funny, revelatory critique of Bel Canto, her wildly popular novel, whose central character is a famous opera singer. Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Ann Patchett taught herself a lot about opera when she wrote Bel Canto back in 1999, and we learned that she has grown to love opera even more in subsequent years, except Wagner operas. We learned that, too, in the book, and we heartily agree. Bel Canto was also made into a movie in 2018 starring Julianne Moore. It's been translated into more than 30 languages. I have grown to love Ann Patchett's work as a novelist and an essayist, and I really enjoyed reading this annotated edition of Bel Canto. Almost every page of this beautiful book contains notes in the margins in Ann's hand with comments about what she would cut, what she would keep, and why. It's a masterclass in writing and editing and a great read for fans of a writer who for years has connected with people across the globe in a powerful way. Because our show was pre-recorded, we can't take any new calls or online comments today. So, Ann, I wonder if you could read a paragraph from page 109 in the book, because you describe it as a writer writing about writing.
Time could barely pull the second hand forward on the clock, and yet look at all the time had, and look at all that had been accomplished. Could it only have been a week to have gone from guns being pushed into backs to most of the guns being locked up in a broom closet should have taken no less than a year, but already the captors knew the hostages would not mount an insurrection, and in return the hostages knew, or almost knew, that they would not be shot by the terrorists. Of course, there were still guards. Two boys patrolled outside in the garden, and three circled the rooms of the house, their weapons pointed out like canes for the blind. The generals continued to give them orders. One of the boys, from time to time, would take a little poke at one of the guests with the muzzle of his gun and tell him to go to the other side of the room for no reason at all other than for the pleasure of seeing them move. At night, there were sentries, but by 12 o'clock, they had always fallen asleep. They did not wake when their weapons slipped from their fingers and clattered to the floor.
So you say in the marginalia, think of this as a novelist talking about writing. So
yeah.
Tell us how that is.
Well, again, it's what I've been doing all morning. You just, there's this feeling of moving tiny people around on a chessboard. And part of it is you have to just keep them moving, and time propels them forward. And one of the hardest things about bel canto was that time disappears at a certain point. A fog sets in, one of the main characters gives away his watch. Nobody knows after a certain point how long they've been in the house. But when you're writing a book, you really need time as a way of organizing things. And it always amazes me because I think, oh, I'll never get this done. I'll never write a whole book. How could I possibly write 350 pages, 400 pages? And yet you just show up and you write a little bit and a little bit and you keep moving the people around. And then it's nighttime and then it's the next morning and then it's the next week and suddenly the novel starts to take shape. It's such a silly thing to say, but it really is like that.
And the novel ends, and you got to come up with another idea for the next novel. I mean, it's a constant churn, but,
It is a constant churn, and I'll say one of the things that makes me really happy is that right now I am about 50 pages into a new novel, but I know what the next novel is going to be. And that is a rarity. So I have basically two books that I really want to write. I love Louise Erdrich, who's a good friend of mine, and she writes like three books at a time. Kate DiCamillo does that too. You know, they'll work on something for a while and they'll get a little stuck and they'll go to the next book and then they're doing editing for one and they're still writing the other one. And I just think I cannot imagine that.
Yeah, that's a very comforting notion, I would imagine, that knowing that when this one's finished, you're good to go on the next one.
Or even when like it's Tuesday and this one's boring, I can go. I can just slip over to the other file on my computer, step out on it.
And Louise Erdrich's new book, The Mighty Red, it's a gorgeous novel.
Oh,
It's
I love that book so
fantastic.
much.
Yeah, me
I love
too.
it.
Me too. Linda is on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to the show with Ann Patchett.
Good afternoon. How lovely to be listening to you. I'm so happy to hear about the constant churn. Bel Canto was the first of Anne's books that I ever read and was so delighted to have discovered, quote unquote, a new author that I could then immerse myself in, and immerse myself I did. Truth and Beauty, The Magician's Assistant, The Dutch House, Commonwealth, Run, all of it. So glorious. So I'm delighted to have this impetus to go back to the beginning and read the new version of Bel Canto, but that's going to set me down the track of rereading it all again. And with two of me in your head ready to come out, can't wait for the next bit too. Thank you so much.
That's so kind. Thank you. I really appreciate that. I was talking to a group of people last week about this, and everybody was saying, "Oh, I really love Bel Canto. It was my favorite book. I don't want to hear what you have to say about it.
Don't wreck it for me.
I don't want to mess with this happy, happy memory." And I was like, "Okay, that's fine. I'm not gonna come to your home and push it on you."
I fully understand you and every other novelist I know not rereading their own work. But are you a rereader of anybody else's work? Of course, you read so much because you do have this bookstore and you're constantly interviewing authors and you're on top of what's going on the literary scene, perhaps more than any person I've ever met. But do you ever reread somebody else? Because, like, I have a friend who reads Anna Karenina every summer. He's a novelist and he
Oh.
reads it every summer. He's read it 30 times.
Oh, what a good choice. That's really wonderful. Eun Lee rereads War and Peace. She did that wonderful project of War and Peace together during the pandemic, where she did something on the internet and then they made a book out of it so everybody could read it together. So I do spend my life reading galleys for the bookstore. We have a first editions club at the bookstore. And my main role at the store is I pick the books for the club. So I'm always reading ahead. I got really far ahead this spring and I decided to take the summer off and just reread things. And the biggest tip that I have for you is I listened to the audio of Jeremy Irons reading Brideshead Head Revisited, which I hadn't read since I was in college. It was astonishing. The audio. Jeremy Irons, so incredible. And then I wound up doing a deep dive into Michael Ondaatje, and I reread The English Patient. I I reread several things, but then I had never read Running in the Family. And it was just a joy. So yes, every now and then I stop, go back and reread something that I love. And then also every now and then, by which I mean like every four or five galleys, I'll read some book that I've always meant to read. I just finished reading The Wide Sargasso Sea.
Oh, I love that book. Yeah.
I'd never read it.
Yeah.
I'd never read it. It's just brilliant. And Edwige Dondicott has an introduction on the new edition. Sublime.
It's interesting you mentioned the audio book, and you have wonderful audio books of your books. I mean, Meryl Streep read The Dutch House, Tom Hanks read The Dutch House.
Right.
Meryl Streep read Tom Lake. I mean, they're fantastic. But you talk about the importance of reading aloud when you are writing. You and I have talked about this before. And you said that there were things in this book that you would have caught had you read aloud. But evidently, I mean, so that indicates that you weren't in that habit back in those
days. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Word repetitions. I use the word flutter probably 8 or 10 times in the book. You can only use the word fluttering one time per book. And things that you hear, you can't necessarily see. When I wrote State of Wonder, I sent the manuscript to Liz Gilbert, and she wrote me back and she said, you're only allowed to use the word ululation once in a novel. You've used it 6 times.
That's right. Used up your quota early.
That's right. One ululation per customer.
You also write, and the writers in the audience will appreciate this, how difficult it is to write a book from the point of view of the omniscient. So you are writing in, some people call it omniscient, third person. And you say it would have been impossible to write this book in the first person because the point of view is going everywhere. But it's a real challenge to write something with someone who knows everything that's going on.
Yeah, yeah. And a real joy. And it was what I was always working towards. Have you ever read Henry Green?
No.
Living, Loving, Party Going. There are the three famous novels, and they're very short and they're published together. But he is the master of the omniscient third. And of course, Anna Karenina.
Yeah.
There we go. We're in everybody's point of view.
Well, the points of view that you elucidate us about in this annotated version of Bel Canto are just terrific. And this is a real great gift to the literary world. So thank you very much. It's always good to talk to you. And I look forward to chatting with you amiably about the next two.
You know, Tom, this is why I write books, so I can come back and talk to you.
Well, that's a dumb reason, but I'll take it. This has been an archive edition of Midday. I spoke with the author Ann Patchett about her latest book, Bel Canto, the annotated edition. That's it for us today. Thanks for listening to Midday on the radio and online. We hope you'll subscribe to our podcast and that you'll check out the show on the WIPR app or on the web at wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.